Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. With a beautiful templates designed by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website with just a few clicks. Squarespace's analytics also help you grow in real time, and if you have any questions, their award-winning 24/7 customer support is there to help. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. And head over to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code TEST, T-E-S-T, so simple to remember, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, September 21st, 2017, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com.
Kind of worked.
Yeah. Thank you, audio engineer Jeremy Williams. How you doing?
At the ready.
How's everyone doing? We have a special guest this week. Kishore is out. He's gone for the week. So we have Mike Micah from Other Ocean.
Hello.
Mike, it's so good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
And I think it's a perfect week to have you in because we're going to talk about some interesting video game topics and technology topics and maybe nostalgic topics.
Mm. Yeah. It's like you know me.
I think you fit with us, with our areas of interest, and hopefully out there with your areas as well.
What shirt are you wearing today?
Oh, like, I am actually wearing, I did a game called iDarb, and one of our artists made this shirt, and it's like constructing the red box. iDarb stands for it draws a red box, so he made a little pixelated version of myself up here.
That's fantastic. So that's like a big construction crew working to draw a single red pixel.
Single red pixel.
That's nice. That's very cool. How are you guys doing? What's been happening lately? It's been a while since you were on the podcast.
That's right. I've actually been pretty busy. It's kind of crazy because I like to do a lot of different things, but it's also kind of a curse because the more I try to do more diverse things, the more things I have to do responsibly. And like I pack it up too much and then my kids miss me. But I've been doing a lot. We at Other Ocean, the Other Ocean side, we just launched Minecraft for 3DS, the Nintendo 3DS. So we're part of the Nintendo Direct, and they announced to the world that Minecraft's coming to the 3DS. They just announced the new 2DS XL not too long ago. And when they made the announcement, they also said that the game's available now. So we surprised everybody and released the game on the same day, and it's been doing really well. And that was a crazy production to get underway. Because if you think about it, the 3DS, not a very powerful machine. Mm-hmm. Minecraft's been doing a lot of crazy things, so trying to get that to work on there is like trying to get Minecraft to run on like the computer inside your washing machine or microwave.
And it supports 3D, I assume?
Right now we're trying to decide whether we want to do that or not, because the frame rate does take a hit, so we're trying to figure out how bad of a hit it takes. And
so it doesn't support it right
not
now?
Not right now,
okay.
But it potentially could.
From a development standpoint, I mean, you know the specs, you've programmed for that platform before, you know Minecraft can be scalable it'll take as much memory as you throw at it if you want it to, so what do you constrain or what do you decide to put inside this version?
Sure.
And how is that decision made?
Well, the first thing you do is you attack the map size. But our map size is 2016 by 2016. I forgot how high. But it's bigger than the Wii U version. So you can actually make larger worlds. And then we did a lot of stuff where we had to get creative on how we save things to the SD card and all that sort of stuff. So it worked out really well there. The frame rate actually is, I think it's locked in at 30, so it never really dips there. We have like stereo we have it working and stuff, but we have to make sure that like that's consistent enough too. So we're working with Microsoft right now and selling that in Mojang. And then we also, the one thing we don't have is multiplayer right now, so we're investigating that as well. In the true like Minecraft fashion, we're just evolving it and seeing how far we can push the system, how far we can push the game.
Right. You have a history of pushing handheld consoles, right? I mean, your companies have probably the biggest history of that, whether it's
true.
The Game Boy or the PSP or the 3DS.
Whenever there's a situation where somebody says, like, how in the hell are we going to get this game to work on something so small and like inferior technology or whatever, from their perspective, we usually get the call. And so it's kind of like our guys love solving that problem. So we go in there, we're like, one of the first things we did that a lot of people still remember is we put Dragon's Lair on the Game Boy Color and it was like full motion video and all this stuff, and people, like, minds were blown when we did that, and that still resonates today. People remember that when they give us a call, like, you did that,
right?
Dragon's Lair.
If you could do that, that's impossible.
Yeah, you can put Minecraft on the 3DS.
Yeah. But from, I mean, I don't remember specifically any of the stories, but the tricks that you rely on aren't always just better compression ratios or something
exactly.
like that. You actually mess with registers and memory in a way that it was never intended to work.
Well, that's how we approach everything that way. We always, like, whether it's even a modern console, we just figure out how we can break it without the, like, the hardware manufacturer getting upset, and then see what kind of tricks happen when we mess with it. So, I mean, we all came from a hacking mentality. We got in the industry by hacking all the time, so it's just like our passion to do that. So,
you mean hacking or cracking?
Maybe a little bit of both. Okay. If you remember, Frodo hacked a lot of games back in the day. I reverse engineered games all the time for either to beat the game or to crack it or to do whatever. And so that was kind of like the beginning of my learning for engineering. So everybody we employ pretty much comes from a background like that.
I love it.
I haven't been into the Minecraft community for so long now. It's obviously exploded. What is the Minecraft experience today? Jeremy, you have a kid who plays Minecraft, right? What are the kids playing?
He just got back into it, actually. He actually just bought... I didn't know that there were people doing this. Like, there are custom servers out there running their own server code that's not open. Like, you can't install this mod, but there are people running code on their servers that change the game so dramatically that they can charge money in order to play on their servers. Like, mm-hmm. There's a mode called Bed Wars.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it.
Well, my son loved it so much that he actually paid for the, you know, the MVP upgrade so that he could, like, make more decisions and open more boxes and stuff like that. I didn't realize there's a whole secondary market, but this is a game where it's you and a friend against these three other teams, and you have to not only kill them, but destroy their bed so that they can't resurrect. And
but there's still a Minecraft element. You're still constructing.
That's what you have to defend your own bed by building the walls.
It feels like it's like Lego. It's like being a master builder, just like putting things up in like Lego movie.
Yeah, and well, I think Minecraft they have embraced that creativity of Lego on a programming standpoint as well as a design standpoint. So anybody can make any kind of game that they want within a certain aesthetic.
It's amazing. Like that, I played a lot with my son. And watch as he kind of took what he learned in Minecraft and now is exploring programming and everything because of it. And after doing this game, being introduced to the wider community of Minecraft, having them like look at us for what we've contributed and being part of like the Minecraft wiki and all stuff, I'm shocked at how welcoming this community is after kind of working with communities like the Street Fighter community and all stuff are really competitive and like... They'll first like tear you down just because like if you have to be frame perfect and everything like that, and then praise you for getting it right and all that kind of stuff. This community is very forgiving on everything, and they're just like they want to hear what the hurdles are. They want to figure out with you on how you can overcome these things and all stuff. It's a very different community versus traditional gaming communities.
You know, I think we were going to talk this up in the tech section, but I think it bears bring right to the top of the show. But let's talk about NES Golf, and let's talk about the Switch week.
Can we at least get into pop culture?
Oh, I think it's the right time to talk about it. We're talking about hacking games. We're talking about nostalgia.
All right.
This is the big story, the true big story this week. Walk me through, how did you guys first hear about this, and were you following along the developments? Because it happened very fast. What we read about 4 days ago is very different than what people are talking about now.
Yeah, and where is it now? So to recap it, essentially, I was just browsing around Twitter, as I do, like, every 30 seconds, and, like, this kind of came up with somebody saying golf was embedded in the Switch OS or you know, somewhere in the firmware. And I'm like, okay, well, that happens all the time. Somebody will put something in there. It was probably some leftover thing. But then it looked like it was even more and more of a complete effort to map motion controls to NES Golf, the classic NES Golf, which is a fun game.
I've never played it. Can you describe the game?
Well, it's in true Nintendo fashion, it really simplifies the sport down to something that's just its primal self. It's like hit the ball, hit it accurate, and how far can you go is based on how accurate you are on hitting the ball at the right time. And it's really fast paced, and it makes it more fun to me than real golf. And I would surprisingly, that was one of the games I got when I was a kid, one of the first games I got for the NES, because nobody else was buying that game, everything else was sold out. So I'm like, oh, I gotta have a game, so I got golf. And I loved it. And so
it came out pretty early, right?
It was one of the first black box games that came out for the NES. And so to have that one kind of embedded in there, I knew there had to be some reasons for it. One, there's the swing mechanic and all stuff. So, yeah, they can try to map that to motion controls and stuff. So I was seeing that kind of coming up, but I still wasn't really – I was kind of like, okay, whatever. But then, like, yesterday, and you guys have probably seen more of this than even I have, like, it seems like you might even be able to access the game now. It's like, it's actually, there's a way to do it, and it had to do in honor of Iwata, who passed away.
Which was pure speculation from the, so that there apparently there are forums, and I'm sure you know this, people hacking, trying to dig into the binaries and dig into the code of the games. And you, like you said, developers and hardware manufacturers putting software, whether it's a game or just code or some Easter egg in product launches, is shipping hardware is not new.
No, right? In fact, I'd say probably 80% of the software out there has something else in it that probably shouldn't be there.
Oh, interesting. So something that's left over or something intentionally.
Oh yeah, we've had stories of like episodes of South Park to pad out CD-ROMs and all this kind of stuff that would always come up, and it's like that happens all the time. And it's easier to put it in there and then just like shut it off than it is to take it out usually.
So this popped up as a mystery initially on like one of the hacking forums, and someone said, I did something weird. It's back in July, like, and I turned on my game, my Switch, my Nintendo Switch, and there was NES Golf, and I didn't think much of it.
I think they had left it alone for a while or something.
Right, right. And then they said they didn't take any screenshots. They just made a claim that it's something that had happened to them.
Whatever.
Yeah. Like, oh, you're high, you're drunk. And like, to their credit, like, I was really sleepy, and maybe it was a fever dream or something. But it was, that was a dated post, timestamp post in the forums. And it wasn't until just last week that another user from that community said, I think this is real. There's actually NES Golf in this.
Well, there's a file called Flog.
Yeah. Right, right. So they dug into, and I guess they made the mental leap that Flog is golf backwards, which, like, that takes some thinking. But how do you access it, right? And there was also hints to, like you said, the motion controller is being used for this. So maybe it was more of a full-fledged game, but why would Nintendo put this in? And so rampant speculation, it seemed like, was the name of the game. People trying to figure out how do you unlock this? Could it be unlocked? And I don't know how, from a hacking perspective, you would uncover the unlock methods, like the fact that it would need to be on a certain date or that motion controls are the ways to actually launch the software. What is it in the code that can give you an indication of that?
Well, usually when you're accessing or calling a function, there is a sequence of bytes that are basically representing that function call. So if you're calling to read controllers, or if you're like checking the clock, you can search for those bytes in that order. And you'll get a lot of misfires, but you'll also get a lot of hits. And so if you're going top to bottom looking for that byte order, it'll just show up. So then the investigation narrows it down from millions of possibilities to like dozens.
Right.
And then you go each one of those and you try to figure things out from there. And the other way that you can do this, especially with this, is if they're actually emulating the game and they've created a wrapper around it, which is most likely what they did, you'll take the original Golf ROM and use that as a filter against the entire firmware dump or the OS dump. And you'll look for those byte orders, and not necessarily the exact bytes, but even just the offset differences. And so you start going through and you're like, okay, this byte is 20 bytes different from the next one, and you do that sort of thing. And then you run a few other more hardcore algorithms in case they're encrypting it and all stuff till you start to find pieces of
it. So you're matching old software emulated, the old ROMs, with what you assume is going to be a version of that in here.
Exactly.
And the big surprise was that there was a full-fledged NES emulator with motion controller support built into Switch, which people would assume would be something would come eventually with some type of emulation support, you know.
Yeah.
But it was the fact that it was built in, like, this could have been just a test case, or it could have been just like,
exactly,
we're testing the emulation, see if the hardware runs.
Because they could conceivably release an old NES emulator within the Switch at any time.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But they had gone to lengths as far as looking at animations in the UI, in the menu, to see if button config, oh, like this frame of this animation for the motion controllers, it has these buttons highlighted, maybe it's moving it like that. But it was really, really cool to just see, and if you go to the thread, just watch people over time try to new things.
That's exactly it. Like, the story of trying to find this is just as compelling, if not more, than just the end result of what will come out of this. Because this kind of, like, investigating, I love this sort of stuff, where it's like, how are you taking this apart? How are you trying to find this information, and how do you recreate it? Because a lot of what goes on right now, especially with, like, even classic game preservation, if we're looking at golf as being a classic game that's kind of being preserved here, people are doing this all the time, working with a group called the Video Game History Foundation, and we're getting old source code and recompiling games that when we recompile them, we realize these games actually have more levels, more characters, more all stuff in them that they didn't have before. But to do that, we have to kind of do the same process. We have to go through and say, like, okay, well, what's going to make this run? How do you get to compile? What are the hurdles? And trying to find things in bigger chunks of data when a CD-ROM's damaged or whatever.
Right. So we should say you can play the game.
Right. So people have, I mean, and people had already previously, without finding an official way to unlock it, they had found a way to pull up the code and play NES Golf. But what they had cared more about was what was Nintendo's, the developer's intention? What were the coder's intention of how you're supposed to randomly unlock it?
Well, and in order to run it at any other, well, you can run it if it's July 11th.
That's the thing. So they found out that it only unlocks on one day, July 11th, which was the day that Iwata passed away. Mm-hmm. And he coded NES Golf.
He was the sole coder.
And so you have a direct tie there. And it turns out that this motion controller pose that you're supposed to do was a pose that he had done on stage during the Switch launch event,
where you hold your controllers perpendicular and move them forward.
Right. So it is 100% a tribute to him and his spirit in every single piece of Nintendo Switch hardware.
Yeah, so this isn't like an Easter egg that's fun for the players. This is more of a spiritual homage to Iwata so he can watch over every Switch.
Yep. That's pretty awesome.
It's pretty great. I mean, I don't know of many developers besides. I mean, you could say like Steve Jobs had that feeling about the original Macintosh.
Yep.
You know, that kind of sentimentality.
Yeah.
That's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. I think that's what sets Nintendo apart for all of us. Like they've had that sort of sentimentality in everything they do. I mean, even their games like Animal Crossing, all this stuff, are just, there's something always deeper about it, spiritually almost, than most other companies put into their games.
It really, as we're following this, because now there is that, you know, you can, there are tutorials now you can follow for new Switch hardware, how to reset the clock, and you know, you can't have it connect to the internet, for example.
You can't have it ever had connected to the internet.
Right, because once it connects to the internet, it locks in your timestamp, that's, your clock is set.
So even if you turn off Wi-Fi, as it's booting up, it does this check to see what's the actual time if I've ever connected to the internet.
Yeah.
Even if my clock has been changed. And if you've ever done that, you can't play the game until July 11th.
It just feels like Ready Player One, like a Holy Grail Easter egg hunt, because what the online community came together, at least that part of the community, came together to uncover it, and they solved it.
And who better? Iwata was an engineer and a programmer who did some really cool things, and like, this is like the best way to honor him. Mm-hmm. It's awesome.
Have you played? Have you guys, either of you with your Switches, tried it?
I couldn't figure out how to get the date set back.
No, way too much work for most people. Way too much work. So, but I will, like, July,
July
11th.
Let's all set our calendars.
No doubt.
And next July 11th,
absolutely,
we will pay tribute and launch NES Golf, and that's going
to
be amazing.
Fun to see. Are there a slight peak in Switch sales, like on July 10th?
Oh, you know, I almost like want to buy a Switch just for it, so it's not tainted and set that date.
Right.
Leave that alone and put a little candles by it and just put Iwata's picture back there. And it's like, that's what it's for.
All right, let's get to our pop culture news. Pop culture news. All of us in this room have been following games and PC gaming, video gaming for a long time, and have not had not been very happy with the Hollywood adaptations of video games. Well, we got the trailer and movie poster for the latest one coming out. It's Tomb Raider, of course. You guys all watched the trailer?
No.
I watched it.
Oh, you did? Okay. Yeah. Now, there have been two previous Tomb Raider movies. Angelina Jolie did two of them before, and I think they were reasonably successful in Hollywood terms.
Mm-hmm.
And
that doesn't speak to your opinion of them.
I think maybe back then when I watched it, I wasn't as critical, maybe. There is the new Tomb Raider trailer. It stars the actress Alicia Vikander, I want to say. I pronounced her last name correct. She was from Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm.
She's a really great actress. She has an Academy Award, I believe. It looks like Tomb Raider.
It looks a lot like Tomb Raider. I'm very happy with it, actually. I think it looks great. I wasn't happy with the poster.
Yeah, so they did I guess, a poster reveal before the trailer reveal, and this has not been a great year for movie posters. Like, Blade Runner had we're very excited for the film, but not a great movie poster with hard orange and blues, and this one specifically is a very classic Laura Croft's back turned to you and turning around looking at the camera, but I'm not sure if it was Photoshop or the lighting was off, but it looked like the actress had a very distorted neck.
And she naturally has a longer neck, but a very natural longer neck, not like the poster. And so it's really hard to kind of figure out. And we're talking about sleuthing for code and all this stuff for golf. But this one, I was so – I'm looking at it, I'm like, there's just something weird about it. And, like, movie posters generally have that because they always take multiple photos and mash them up. So they mm-hmm. have the very unnatural, like, their head's 180 degrees facing back. And, like, you can't do that. But this one, it was even weirder because, like, the neck tends to be almost twice as long as her natural neck. In the way she's posing it. So I drew over it. I'm sort of trying to figure it all out. And then finally I posted on Twitter the old one plus a new one I fixed up with I based off of the artist's way of doing like your neck length when you're drawing. And so I put it back on there. And like that's probably one of my most popular tweets this year because people started retweeting that and passing it around and then wanting to fight me because they're like, she's beautiful. I'm like, I think she is too. But like this Photoshop, not so much.
Yeah.
And,
really? You had people disagree? Because I thought your Photoshop job was...
Thank
quite
you.
Really good.
Yeah, and I did it really fast because I'm just like, this is how artists like draw people, and like this is what she needs to be. But then, yeah, I've had a few people kind of come back and go like, how dare you, neck shamer? And I'm like, oh, God.
Neck shamer.
She's fine.
I wonder if that Twitter handle's taken.
Yeah, neck shamer.
It's Photoshop shaming.
Exactly.
It's marketing shaming.
Which, like you said, we've seen a lot of these bad Photoshops recently, and I really do hate that process that they go through. There's a certain kind of framing you got to do, and there's a certain kind of like get them facing you almost completely, and then take one of their back and make this unnatural pose.
Well, the thing I think I found the most egregious in terms of style for movie posters is the big heads, like a pyramid of heads.
Yep.
Right. And I think Spider-Man probably had the most egregious one because it's composite of the actors weren't all in the same room at the same time, probably different lighting.
Yep.
And it's not an easy job for an artist to take that. It's they have to
come
up with a ton of stuff, different direction. And they probably weren't involved in the creative process for those photo shoots, but they had to get certain actors, certain head sizes this big because of contractual obligations and fit in all the details and get taglines in there. And so I don't envy their job.
Not
but
at
when,
all.
When it's done well, you don't notice it. It's striking. It captures your attention, makes you interested in watching the movie. But when it's bad, it's also striking with completely unintended results. And of course, with the internet and how well people just can Photoshop themselves or share bad posters. Yeah.
It gets people thinking about that rather than the movie.
Absolutely.
So it's kind of problematic. But the trailer looks fantastic. It reminds me of the recent console games.
I think that's exactly what they base it off of, right? It's and I think this is a great chance because Tomb Raider came out before Uncharted. And Uncharted, I think, is probably more popular these days. But Uncharted, that movie has been in development hell for a long time. And so here's a great chance for the character Lara Croft to take over that mantle of and really... show that character is, this is why we love Lara Croft.
Exactly.
The adventure.
Is there a good video game movie?
Oh, that's a good question.
There are movies that I think are, that you love, but aren't great ones. Like Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
The first Mortal Kombat.
I love Mortal Kombat, but it's not a great movie.
It's not a great movie at all. But I love what they try to do with it. I love the weirdness of a lot of it.
Do not agree. What else? Next.
I couldn't say the same thing for Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, God.
That's notable.
The answer is no.
I guess there's good movies. Well, generally good movies about video games. Maybe they weren't, but like Last Starfighter always stands out to me.
Just watched that again recently.
Yeah, but that's not about a
It's not
real
about a
video.
Specific game. Yeah.
You're talking about adaptations, Jeremy,
You're talking about adaptations,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And what's the difficulty? I think... the assumption is that, from the public's view or from the video gamer's perspective is that, the filmmakers, they were riding too much on the brand of the game and the characters, and they felt like they didn't have to put as much effort into the story or character arc.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I fear that there's a misunderstanding that if it's about video games, then your audience is stupid.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's actually the opposite.
It is. It
and
is.
So that's where somebody's got to figure that out.
That's why they're always shocked that like gamers come out of the woodwork going like, you got this wrong, and they're like flipping out about it.
But then they also think that gamers care about certain things, and so they try to put fan service into the movies and with nods. I mean, that's not exactly what I think gamers want anyway. What they want is the filmmakers understand why gamers care about not a character, whether it's Master Chief or whether it's, Call of Duty, a character in the game, not just of the setting, not just of the special effects or the graphics or the quippy dialogue or the action. I think Doom famously got that wrong, right?
Exactly.
I don't think people care that they had a first-person action sequence in the movie because Doom was a first-person game. That's a very overt fan service head nod, but it didn't do anything for the characters.
No, and any gamer watching it was just kind of like probably rolling their eyes, going like, okay, they just could care less about the story and they're just trying to like placate gamers, and this is their perspective on everything.
The thing has also changed that the audience, gamers are not a niche community anymore. No. I think when you're talking about making a movie adaptation 10 years ago, they were thinking, okay, we got to make a movie that's going to appeal to the mainstream and also to these weird gamers, but gamers are the mainstream.
And I've been involved in a lot of potential game-to-movie kind of situations where I'm in the room with people who are talking about, like, well, if we're going to do this, and the game's going this way, the TV show would do this, the movie would do this, or whatever. And it's kind of interesting to me because the problem we always run into is when you're playing a game, it's interactive. You're empathizing with a character who is part you and part a character in the story.
You put a lot of yourself in there.
Your narrative goes into it as well. And so when you try to put that on screen or create a linear narrative out of that, you're taking just one person's combined narrative and try, or maybe three people's, and trying to put that on screen, which is not necessarily the story you experience. Skyrim's a great example, where like people play Skyrim and have like different ways they retell their experience with that game in dramatic ways, and it's like that is really challenging to do on screen.
Right.
Right. And also games have mechanics, and
they do.
Going back to Doom, first person shooting is a mechanic, and the fact that filmmakers feel like the mechanic has to be a part of the film to make it, like, think of the Max Payne movies.
Yeah.
Well, Max Payne had bullet time. Well, let's go extreme bullet time as a part of the storytelling device in the film. I don't think that's necessary.
I don't know. It seems expected, but it's not what I would go to see the movie for.
Exactly. Yeah, I think fans of whatever video game series just want their characters in that world to be respected and told, and let the filmmakers use the best tools of their ability, their best storytelling tools, and the actors their best abilities to pay tribute to these brands and these franchises.
How was World of Warcraft?
Warcraft.
Oh yeah,
Warcraft. Sorry, just Warcraft. How was that? Did anybody see that?
I started to watch it.
Okay, enough said.
that was another great example of a game that people have put like so much into and had their own view of what that was. And so I think a lot of people were excited to see the places and the creatures and that sort of thing, but it wasn't the story they necessarily wanted to see. Yeah. But, you know, if Tomb Raider had a double jump in the game, I would suspect Hollywood would have a moment where the movie kind of stops and they're like, how are we going to reach that? And she's like, I'll double jump. You know?
That's amazing. It's great for a parody.
Exactly.
And there have been plenty of like video game movies about video games that would take that could take advantage of that.
You know who hasn't really given this a shot yet is Blizzard. And they have so much story built up already.
They do those small movies, those short films.
No doubt.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But exactly. And I feel like they've put so much thought and care into that. If they were to do a full-fledged movie, they would not only get the lore and what players, movie watchers, would care about. Maybe, you know, that could be the winner.
I think we're probably missing one good example of an adaptation out there, because there have been so many.
Yeah.
Like, there's probably one. I mean, we'd love to hear from you guys. What do you think are the best, like,
one had to work, right?
One had to work.
Like, I want to see my Crazy Taxi movie or something like that, or like find these like weird esoteric ones that are just like bizarre.
Yeah,
like, those are easier to make.
Yeah. Speaking of adaptation, or I guess reboots. We all love Terminator. You guys love Terminator. Mm-hmm. There's a new Terminator film coming out.
I guess so. I don't think I ever saw the last one.
Terminator. What was that one? Genesis.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see Salvation or Genesis.
Oh yeah. Okay. James Cameron's coming back to produce a new Terminator film with starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Linda Hamilton.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. Is this a good idea?
You know, I thought Terminator should have just stopped a long time ago. But like, I feel like if anybody's going to try, it's just like I feel the same way about Blade Runner. If anybody's going to try, it should be with a majority of the creative team that did it originally, especially if they want to try to prove something. Like, of course, do it. But if this doesn't work, it's done. Just bury it. Don't, like, no cartoon shows, no weird kids' toys, which always blows my mind because, like, these are, like, really violent, like, movies. And it's like, oh, here's the kids' line of toys. Or it's like, I'm buying my son a Tomb Raider at 10, like, whatever, you know, or even younger. Like, remember they had Rambo and RoboCop toys, too. Like, looking back, I can't fathom it. As a kid, I just thought, of course. But
yeah, robots. Robots are great. Yeah. Like, do the bow and arrow. Awesome. But no, you know what the source material was and how dark that was.
And so, like, with Terminator, like, how far are they going to go this time around? I just want to see them finally kind of address it. I to prepare for this, I forgot the name of it. They're James Cameron and Bill Wisher, who worked together, I think, on Terminator and Terminator 2, created a short film a long time ago that when you watch it, you're like, oh, this is Terminator. I see this now. And even bits of Aliens are in there. So I watched that because I'm like, okay, I just want to get back in the groove of what their vision for things were and kind of catch up. So I watched that. I watched the first Terminator. I'm in the middle of Terminator 2. I have kids, so I always watch movies in parts, which sucks. But like I'm real there. So now I'm going to stop and wait for this one.
Yeah, which I think was the idea. This idea that this is, because James Cameron has not been involved. He wasn't involved in 3 or Salvation or Genesis. So this just comes as the new sequel. Screw the timeline. Screw what other people have done with it.
Oh, really?
Since this is just a direct continuation of 2 as he would have envisioned it. He's not directing. He's busy doing Avatar. But that's what I'm hopeful for.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure he had a vision going into the first 2 films of where these characters ended up. And I think where the characters ended up is maybe that gives you a little bit of closure. But the problem I have with some of these films is the themes that were in the first films were super relevant and super resonant back then. But kind of now, the world's changed.
Yep.
And you can't just say technology is evil and make that the theme. And it's ominous and scary. But the movies have done that already to death.
I don't know. But I do think AI is more in the public consciousness now than it ever has been. Certainly, given Elon Musk's public comments about it and the developments that we've seen, we now have computers that we talk to in our pockets. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more that resonates with people now, even more than in the 90s.
My problem with a lot of those science fiction, you know, the future, the dangers of the future, dangers of technology movies, and there are so many of them now, is that they try to be realistic. They try to tap into things that social media is evil or, you know, like surveillance is evil. And yeah, that's at some point veer toward fantasy, veer toward like you've already built a world where like machines design endoskeletons to look like humans. Lean on that. That's your conceit.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be a reflection of the real world. Like that's what people loved about Terminator 1 and 2 is the machine that won't stop.
Yeah.
And that chase, right? That's what made both the first one and the second one, like bring that fear back into it.
It's what makes it kind of timeless because even last night I watched Westworld, the original movie, watching the series.
Oh, yeah,
the original
Terminator.
Yeah, it's like kind of the original Terminator. And like, I'm like, this still holds up. Like, this is like kind of in the themes that they're going for and the sort of things they're trying to say works just as much today as it did then. That's why that new series can exist and everything as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Terminator's kind of in that category. But then when I watched like Terminator Genesis and stuff, I felt like they were just trying so hard to do a best of, like a hits tape, a mixtape of stuff to like keep you coming back because it's
two
one
had
more.
This thing. Let's go bring more.
Exactly.
And it's okay to be reductive. It's okay to take a step back and simplify things.
Yeah.
And I think Hollywood maybe is a little maybe afraid to do that.
I mean, look at what Logan. Logan was a good example
that's
of how you
example.
Can do that, right? Like,
yes.
And not that we want old man Terminator now. Like,
we're going to get that no matter what.
But there's going to be something to it. Like, you can do more with that.
My only fear is that we're going to have another case of don't question the genius. With Cameron back in the helm, you know, with all the success now of Avatar, as well as him having made, you know, half the great sci-fi movies in history, I fear that he won't have people on his shoulders saying, that's not a good idea, and we're going to have George Lucas all over again.
Oh, yeah, the George Lucas prequel syndrome kind of thing.
Exactly. He's a different type of filmmaker now. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not as scrappy, not as grungy. And,
yeah.
But he's a master of making a spectacle that's also a crowd pleaser.
Yep.
Like for you know, if you look back at Avatar and people think, you know, oh, that's such a generic story, but it's, you know, it's a hero's journey. He tapped into, in essence, a thing that resonated with people and it worked.
Yeah.
And he brought something new to the screen.
Yeah.
And I think that's always been his pushing, motivating factor.
Yep.
Now, speaking of other reboots, did you guys watch the Watchmen film? Zack Snyder's Watchmen film?
Yeah.
Did you guys like it?
I was mixed. It was one of those things where I feel like you can't touch the comic very well and do justice to it. And Zack Snyder, I started to lose faith in him at that point. So I don't know. I couldn't get
into
it.
Because it was after 300. I honestly, I like that film.
You did.
I do. I like the exercise that he went through and trying to be as pure of an adaptation as possible. And obviously, the ending is changed. Not, no big spoilers here. But Watchmen may be coming back in some form, and I'm very excited because it looks like it's going to be a long-form TV series with Damon Lindelof behind it. So Damon Lindelof, the co-showrunner of Lost and also of The Leftovers most recently, which I love that show, he just posted a picture of the writer's room for the Watchmen TV series. So it's coming back.
Sounds expensive.
It does sound expensive, but I think when we talk about we're in the quote-unquote golden age of television where networks are willing to spend a lot of money on long-form serialized stories where Watchmen may fit in. And I know Alan Moore is knocking me on board, and I'm okay. I'm resigned to the fact that the creator of the original source material never wants any of his, you know, thinks the comics was the way to tell the story back in the 80s. But as a fan of the series, I'm excited to see what this storyteller is going to
do. Well, that's the thing. Like, I really do believe, like, if the original creator is not behind something, and the best way, if you're going to move forward with it anyways, the best way you can do it is, like, give it to the hands of the fans who really love the material and are going to do it right.
And are capable. Yeah, and have proven capable. Themselves in writing something that's similar, something filled with mystery, something yep. filled with fantasy, science fiction, and nonlinear storytelling.
Yep.
These are things that Damon Lindelof excels at. And so that's why I'm excited.
I'm excited about it because of that and the time that we're going to have with these characters, because that was my biggest gripe with the movie that Zack Snyder did, is that I just felt like there wasn't enough time for him. Like, I wanted to get to know these characters the way I got to know them in the comics.
Right.
And there was just no way that was going to happen in the time they had. So this series actually has me pretty excited. And again, like, I know a lot of people are kind of upset if the involvement of everybody else that should be involved aren't there, but like, I do know that everybody on this team seems to be like the biggest fans ever. So if I equate it to what happened recently in games with fans who created Sonic Mania, that team who created this game that's like the true sequel now to Sonic that everybody's been waiting for came from fans and it had nothing to do with the original Sonic.
Wait a minute. That game that came out 2 weeks ago on Steam is made by fans?
Yes.
You're kidding.
At the end of the day, it was these fans who were hacking Sonic for years and extending Sonic and doing all this stuff with Sonic that came together and made that game.
Wow.
You mean on Switch?
On Switch.
It's on Steam
and
as well.
And Xbox 4. Oh, okay. Or Xbox One and PS4.
That's amazing, because it's a good game.
It's fantastic, and it feels like a true sequel.
It totally
games.
Feels like
and
Sonic.
And like, for Sonic fans, this is what they've been waiting for forever. So that same kind of thing, you see it with fans of create shows as well.
And it's not
Game
about,
of Thrones is that.
Right. And it's not about nostalgia in terms of bringing back old series. It's not about making it exactly as it was. It's about what you loved about it. And so when you watch it, when you play a game, it's how you remember it in your head, which
exactly.
is always better than what it actually was.
Yeah. And we talk about that all easy. The time when people are always asking us, can you emulate a game or bring a game back or whatever? And the real way to kind of do a lot of these games is like, what you remember is not what it is anymore. And so if you can create what you remember about that game and give that to people, that's what they're really wanting. And so you need to kind of go back and remaster the stuff.
On that subject, I played a little bit of Space Quest 1 with my son because I got my little computer museum all hooked up. All my old PCs are actually running. And boy, was game design bad back then. As much as I hated, you know, some of the advancements like point and click, I actually liked typing into my old adventure games. Some of the stuff where if you miss an object, you're screwed.
Yeah.
That's just bad design. You shouldn't do that to people.
Well, things were still evolving at that time when you really think about it. I was just reading a book. I should probably recommend it here. It's called Breakout. Have you guys heard of this book? It's by, I think it's David Craddock is his name. And it's How the Apple II Launched the PC Gaming Revolution. Hmm. I'm reading through it, and it's a collection of stories of people who made all the classic games from like Karateka to Lode Runner and all stuff, and it's like the origin stories of all these games. And you realize when you're reading this that this was all happening for the first time. So there were no rules. There were no like, oh, design should do X, Y, and Z. They were just experimenting and putting the experiment out and just evolved from there. So Space Quest is a great example of that, where there's no way you could ship a game like that right now without everybody just like making sure you go out of business and never work again.
With the book's called Breakout?
Yeah, it's called Breakout. And it's based off like Steve Wozniak made Breakout for the Apple. That was like kind of the first thing that was put on it, and it just kind of carries on from there.
He ends, well, Steve Jobs, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They did the Atari Breakout, also when they were working for Atari.
Oh,
or
gotcha.
When Steve Jobs is working for Atari, but then subcontracting to Wozniak.
Right.
Quote, subcontracting.
That's great.
One last bit of pop culture news.
Sad.
A little sad, on a down note. Toys R Us is filed for bankruptcy.
Toys R Us was my mecca, man.
Oh.
When I was a kid, it was the, like, I wanted to go nowhere on earth but Toys R Us. And
we don't have that kind of place anymore.
No.
No, it's only Toys R Us. And the thing is, I remember eating cereal and looking at the back of the box when those contests would come out where it's like, win a shopping spree,
ten minutes,
all you can grab.
Oh, I remember that.
At Toys R Us. And like, that was my fantasy. I would dream about that as a kid. Like, I would literally wake up and go, did I win? Like, I would dream about
it. You'd strategize. You'd draw out the aisles. Yep. Go to Toys R Us. I would grab this first. I would grab that first.
Yeah.
I would love to hear from a contest winner who had done that.
That would be amazing.
Right? And how they spent their time, whether they sell the toys, whether it fulfilled their wishes. I think not winning the contest probably was for the best, because you could live the fantasy in your head.
Yeah.
My strategy was I would go down the game aisle and just grab the paper tags and fill a shopping cart, just grab every single one and go down, like, well, computers, smart. The consoles or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of suspected that there was going to be some small print.
I
wouldn't read. So
it must fit in this one shopping cart. Everything that you...
Cannot be paper.
It can't
right,
be paper.
Right, right. Yeah.
I love Toys R Us. So they're not actually closing yet.
Right? No. They actually run through this holiday season, but they are not in good financial mm-hmm. health. And, you know, it's sad because they were the last toy department store. You know, we had, I guess there's KB Toys, where I grew up as well.
Circus World, Children's Palace, mm-hmm. all these people who tried to defeat Toys R Us, but they owned the category.
It's FAO Schwartz.
FAO Schwartz. Oh, yeah. That's
I'm not sure they count.
That's a elevated, and that was a boutique. But it's the last place. I mean, all Toys R Us, they all look the same too, right?
Yeah.
They're all that kind of boxy shape. You walk in, it's aisles. And aisles of toys.
Is this another example of Amazon killing off brick and mortar?
I mean, I think for sure. And you know, toys are actually not the easiest thing. I mean, I think Target and online and Amazon have been better at getting toys, but it's still the best experience to see a thing in person.
Well, last weekend, I had my kids for a little while while my wife was working, and I'm like, what do you guys want to do? What do you want to do? And they're just like, Toys R Us. And I'm like, all right. So they didn't buy anything. They were just like, check out the bikes. They're sitting in the big cars and just goofing around the whole time. I'm like, we probably should have bought something now in hindsight. But like, it was just an experience for them still to go in there and just see things. They like to like shop for everything and look at it and kind of that touchy-feely bit that you just can't get online. It's important.
It's like, you know, setting your own man cave up or your own den with all your toys. It's trying to recreate that feeling of being surrounded by inspiration.
How many people are probably going to do that if they go to business? It's like, I'm going to put a big cage in my garage full of video games and ask people to bring a piece of paper up and hand it over. Because that was the ritual, right? You'd go pay for it and then you go to the cage and they'd go find the stack of games and give you your like Top Gun NES game.
I used to think, I literally thought the store was made of toys. Because it's called Toys R Us, and I explained to my mom at a very young age that that's why it was named that.
The walls were lined with toys.
Everybody that works there is part toy because it's them. Giraffes are just building them in the back.
Right. Jeffrey.
And, you know, there are plenty of mom-and-pop toy stores.
Yeah.
They're probably aimed for younger kids, like, you know, board games. Obviously, there are board game stores that kind of take up that mantle. But, like, you know, for dolls and for puzzles and, you know, we have boutiques, at least in the Bay Area. And you know, even around the country, and so hopefully those will stay alive.
Yeah,
inventory management was probably the toughest thing.
Exactly, and like, but then you have the guys like Hasbro and stuff whose stock took a hit on the news. Yeah. So even toy companies who manufacture toys are getting a little bruised by it. And so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, because not everyone is online, or not everyone follows like the Comic-Con scene and knows exactly the you know, the Star Wars Black Series and what dates are coming out. A lot of people just go to the store and just want to buy something. You know, spend $10 to buy something for their kids. Yeah. You know, Kishore's not here, and I think we're all iPhone users, but we're going to start off with some Google Android news. This big news just broke last night. Google is not quite buying HTC, but it's acquiring employees of HTC who worked on their Pixel phone and also non-exclusive rights to their IP, which I believe includes some of their VR assets.
Hmm.
So HTC, Taiwanese company, they had at some point, I think, 10% of the smartphone market share. Very fond memories of HTC because they made the first Android phone, the T-Mobile mm-hmm. G1.
Oh, wow.
The HTC Dream. Do you remember that? The slider phone, the keypad? Yeah. And they had been manufacturers of like Windows mobile phones even back then, you know, 2006, 2005. But they have been struggling of late, at least on the smartphone market. I think they have very, very small market share, largely because of Asian market competitors. But hopefully this will give them the cash influx, $1 billion, that they need to stabilize their business.
That's like one-third or one-fourth Minecraft value.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. But for Google, you know, this is like the second big investment in a phone company they've had in the past decade. They bought Motorola, of course, which they then offloaded to Lenovo. But now they have a more established homegrown phone line, their Pixel line, which from far off from the Nexus. And so this will maybe bolster that, and we'll get some really good Pixel phones in the next couple of years.
What will this mean for the Vive?
Not sure.
Yeah.
And for the HTC Vive, there was talk about them splitting off those assets or maybe putting Vive up for sale. They're still coming out with products.
Yeah.
You know, they're still running Vive port. They're still going to have the HTC Dream. Or no, I'm sorry. The what's the standalone HTC headset coming out in this year. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the VR minute. Maybe news will even break between now and then. Okay, who knows?
Fingers crossed.
But for back in the Apple world, Apple Sphere, we had the keynote, the big announcement, September event last week. We podcasted right after that.
Yep.
Since then, products are out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like almost all the products, the Apple Watch, the iPhone 8, mm-hmm. and the Apple TV are all available either for pre-order or purchase today, essentially. And the reviews are out. So iPhone 8 reviews. You guys read the reviews?
After I bought mine.
You did?
Is this an 8?
This isn't an 8 yet. Okay. It's sitting on my porch, I think, right now.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are you upgrading from?
I'm upgrading from a 6. I was kind of, I missed 7, so I'm kind of eager to get up there. But then I did what everybody's supposed to do, where you go to about, I'm doing it right now.
Checking your 30
checking my
bits.
Applications. And then, oh my God, look at all these apps that will not work on iPhone 8.
App compatibility.
Because it won't run 32-bit apps.
It won't run 32-bit apps.
That's
and so I thought like, oh, maybe 5 or 6. But I go through it and I can't update. I went through and tried to update every single one of these.
Yeah, but do you use any of those?
I would probably, honestly, I probably only use like maybe like 8 out of the 200 here or something like that on a more regular basis, which is sort of upsetting because there are kind of apps that are important to me. For like I have them connected to my home network and I do all stuff. I think so. Now I don't have buyer's remorse or buyer's regret, but I almost do because I'm like, we'll see what happens. I'm going to try it out, and if it doesn't work out, I'm going to be kind of.
It's kind of that planned obsolescence of the app on the software side because there is no backward compatibility there. This is the first big time.
Yep.
And a lot of people have been waiting for this model to upgrade. I know plenty of people with 6s or 5s. But this is also perhaps the last iPhone with Touch ID. So if you want to hold on to Touch ID, I'm curious about this launch. The reviews are good. So I think the reviewers really like the phone. They said that, yes, it looks very much like the 7 and the 6. The glass back feels good, feels grippy, which is what they're saying. It obviously does the inductive charging with the Qi chargers. The Qi charging isn't particularly fast, which is another takeaway from the reviews. It's slower than plugging it in, and it doesn't have the fast USB-C charging as well either.
To be expected.
To be expected. No headphone jack as well. The screen looks great. The True Tone color screen looks great. The camera, everyone loves the camera. And everyone says the speed is amazing on this. The benchmarks are saying this is an iPhone, and it's the same processor, I think, as what's in the iPhone X. It's faster than modern day. That MacBook Pro you have sitting in front of you, perhaps.
Well, this MacBook Pro is at least 6 months old.
Oh, it's already obsolete. But the phone is faster than your Pro, at least in some sub-web benchmarks. Yeah, battery life is supposed to be amazing as well. Did you get the large size or the small size?
I got the smaller size.
So you don't care about the dual camera?
I don't care about the dual camera. I almost did, but I'm like, I take the form factor for small, like much over that. So.
Me too.
They raised the price. It's $50 more.
What is?
For the 8 and the 7.
Huh.
And they launched it last year, the launch price. And I think that's partly because they start at 64 gigs of storage, and there's a little more RAM in this one than last year.
They raised other devices by $50 too. They said it was due to RAM prices going up.
Yeah, RAM prices going up. So 64 gigs and 256 gigs for $150 more. Only two models this time. There's no
in between.
No in between. 128 would be really sweet, but $150 for 256.
You're going to eat up all that anyways with the 4K video. And
totally. So I think that's the thing that as the cameras get better and you can do high-speed video and 4K video, you want as much storage. You can't get by. I can't believe they had 16 gigs up until last year
for the entry level. Watching those poor people try to upgrade just their iOS.
Yes.
Because it takes 2 gigs alone just to download it and upgrade.
So iOS 11 also released.
Well, I just want to ask real quick. You don't care that it has no headphone jack?
You know what? Even coming here today, I was just using wireless headphones anyways. Okay. So I've kind of lost the wires now.
You've gone there.
Yeah.
Jeremy, you cannot abide.
I'm not going to let go of this. This is a fight I'm going to fight until I'm 80 years old.
Wow. So you're sticking, you have a 6S.
There's just no reason
which
to remove
it. Which has a headphone jack.
When you watch the video a guy in China made of adding a headphone jack to his own 7, there was space for it. It was almost as if there was a headphone jack that was removed. You know,
it was the space they just labeled as spite in their little.
No, they labeled it courage.
It's
the courage space.
It's courage fits right there.
Apple wanted to remove that analog hole. They wanted to remove this open jack that anybody could tap into without licensing their adapter. Mm-hmm. I just don't see there as being a reason. I don't buy that it needs to be more compact, and I'm upset about it. And I'm just fighting.
So no iPhones for you forever.
Just what? Fighting the fight.
I you know, I respect that, and I was there a year ago laughing about like how could they even do it or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, now they're not like forcing you to use their inductive charging.
I was surprised by
that. I was shocked.
Right.
And so I'm like, oh, I'm going to spend $200 for a charger now. And it's like, oh, I can use whatever I want.
$60
I can use my toothpaste
charger.
Maybe in a year I will give up. We'll see. But I am not upgrading my phone.
I was sitting there complaining about it the whole time, and somebody at the office had to remind me, like, do you even have headphones with wires? And I'm like, no, but stupid.
But I like the idea of thinking of getting nice, really nice headphones.
Very nice audio.
Yes, very nice for an audio file. But then you wouldn't run that off the DAC on the iPhone either. You'd give it separate amp.
It turns out they do make those One More earbuds that Patrick likes. Those are his favorite earbuds under $100. They do make those with a lightning jack.
Oh,
so that is the option. But the lightning version is $50 more expensive.
Of course.
Whoa. Yeah. And of course, it takes up that slot unless you have a splitter.
I don't mind.
Okay.
I'm not going to charge the same time. All right. Oh. Sorry. So back on track.
Yeah. In addition, so for you, someone not getting a new phone, you don't care about the 10, you know, you'll let me get the 10 and you'll look at it then?
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
My take. I'm like, I'll wait to see what somebody else has when they get the 10 and take a look at it, but I wasn't eager to get it. That was weird.
You know what? I think people who are already, I'll think about this, like, they're already supply constrained on the 10. That's why it's pushed to October 26th. It's a month away from now before people can even pre-order, and a month and a week before it'll even ship. So it's going to be limited. The people who have already committed to buying a 10, who have the money and want to have something that stand out, they're sold. They don't care about the reviews, right? The Face ID stuff, you know, I think they've assuaged enough of those fears. People are going to buy it anyway. I think it's really important for the iPhone 8 reviews when those came out this week, for those to be good.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, people are going to buy the 7.
Yep.
It's so much cheaper, $150 cheaper. And or even the 6S, which they still sell.
Yeah.
So, you know, for people who have a 5 or a 6 and are wanting to upgrade, you know, it seems like the 8 reviews are good. And for you, Jeremy, who's not upgrading, did you at least update to iOS 11?
Yeah.
You did.
ASAP. I was on the beta for my iPad.
Ah.
And I really like it. I'm surprised how well it runs on the 6S. It's perfectly smooth. When you first get it installed, it's a little alarming because everything's choppy. But after a half hour, it's great. I'm quite a fan of iOS 11.
Do you like the biggest change? Maybe the control center. So the way you swipe up from the bottom of the phone to get access to your shortcuts, now it looks completely different. Mm-hmm. And what's been revealed as of yesterday for people using iOS 7 is that the button that people use a lot to enable or disable Wi-Fi or enable or disable Bluetooth doesn't actually work as 10. Doesn't turn off the radios. When you press the Wi-Fi button on the new control center, it just prevents the phone from connecting to Wi-Fi networks.
That's not what I want.
But Wi-Fi is still on for AirPlay and for what's the file system transfer?
AirDrop.
Yep.
And same with Bluetooth for your watch. You can turn off Bluetooth, like airplane mode will turn off Bluetooth, but the radio will still be on for connecting to your watch. Now, you can manually turn off by going to settings and toggling it off completely, but for the shortcut, it won't do that, which sounds like a very Apple-like decision, right?
Yeah, like, very much.
Like, we will give you something that transparently looks like one thing, but it's going to work the way we think you want you to use your device and not a very obvious on-off switch.
One feature that caught me by surprise is, do you guys have an Apple TV? Is that even a problem?
Not anymore.
Okay. I have no new one.
It's what we live on. Like, it's what we don't have cable. We just have Apple TV. And so we use it all the time. The remote, as we all know, is kind of divisive. You know, it's very symmetrical, hard to understand sometimes, just especially in the dark. But so now it's a part of Control Center. If you launch Control Center while you have Apple TV running, you can add a button for Apple TV. And it's not an app. It's just part of the OS. And you tap it, and suddenly your screen is in remote. So it's very convenient. Like, you can navigate everything. You can even do Siri. I was surprised by that it's just baked right into the OS now. That's really handy. I also like the new Siri voices.
Oh, that's the other thing with iOS 11. The default voice change as well?
Default voice changes to a male American.
What?
Yeah. But you can switch to a female, but it's a new voice.
Whoa.
So Siri, as we know her, is gone?
Thank goodness, because I had a bad relationship with her.
Wait. Oh, but that was just psychological, because you had the software. We talked about this, right? Like,
say what you will.
We had associated the poor performance of the Siri and with the voice.
Oh, of course.
And so as they improved the back end, then did it make sense for them to keep the voice and have it grow, or just change the voice completely?
All right, so here's the new... the new male American.
Which is the default.
Actually, here's the new female American.
I'm Siri, your virtual assistant.
It's different.
Totally different.
It's very
right?
different.
It's like recasting Darren's on Bewitched.
They do model these on real people.
Exactly. Right?
Here's the new default.
I'm Siri, your virtual assistant.
Nope.
Yeah, I'm not going
to
do that.
So what I switched to is female British.
I'm Siri, your virtual assistant.
I'm a fan, but the British...
That's like Iron Man.
The British male is great.
I'm Siri, your virtual assistant.
How about that? I mean, that sounds like a real person.
It does.
I've always been a fan of voice synthesis and watching it go ever since Dr. Spatzo, right? Like in the 80s on my Sound Blaster. And this is top of the... top technology right
What's
now.
Cool is that all of those voices, all those phonemes and all the recordings are on the phone.
Yeah.
Preloaded into the OS.
No, they actually download.
Oh, they download? Yeah. Interesting. Now, but there's a way that you can download all of them, have them loaded up.
Yep.
Just like a language pack. I'm wondering, as we go forward, it's almost like the version of her in the future. Can there be different flavors or versions of the AI that they can fork and have them have conversations with?
How soon will Apple just start, like, you know, working with people to put like C-3PO for the week, like they do with GPS apps and all that stuff?
Right.
Maybe a third-party developer will make the best, like, C-3PO is a translator, so that's, you know, just design the voice for the function, not just one assistant that can do everything. But I know British female Siri voices give me the best food recipes and food recommendations. And maybe male British Siri voice is going to be the best driving directions. Not to stereotype anything, but just saying, like, to differentiate, you know, the voice with the functionality.
It's neat to me how they make these, too, that they actually do use, they model them off real people.
Yeah.
They get somebody to go into a booth and record these funny sentences that represents every phoneme that you could possibly say and every combination. And then they use computer learning to basically train the computer how to speak like that. And then it can actually synthesize that voice.
They got it down to, like, I think, well, last I saw them working on stuff like that for games, they got it down to about 5 pages of text.
No kidding.
And people just read through that, and it generally gets it, and there's going to be some weird edge cases. Mm-hmm. But then there was, like, even I saw a documentary a long time ago that half the documentary was actually not a person. It was a speech synthesis that you thought was the person who started the documentary, but it was based off of their voice.
The same person.
Yeah. I got to track that down. I'll post that documentary too. It was pretty cool.
It's not like the Speak and Spell. Speak and Spell was actually like pre-recorded.
Yeah.
It wasn't synthesis.
No.
It was sort of like early MP3.
You know, I also wonder if they changed the voice of Siri because the actress who had, they had bought, when, mm-hmm. when Apple had bought the company that had developed Siri initially, they had got the voice from a voice actress and who did not know about it and discovered that she was the voice of Siri and now, you know, been recognized as a voice, just like GLaDOS for a Portal. And now she's no longer the voice of Siri. And maybe it was contractual or maybe it was a royalty.
Well, she was doing voices in movies and stuff, like she did Lego Batman.
She was in Lego Batman Siri.
Shut up, Siri. What?
Yeah.
Hey Computer in Lego Batman was voiced by the actress who did, because it was all custom dialogue.
I thought they made Siri say those things.
No. They hired the actress. And now they can't do that anymore because she's no longer the voice of Siri.
That's great.
I wonder,
people's lives impacted.
But listening to you be upset at her, basically, for being your phone's like problems or whatever, like I wonder if she gets refused service at restaurants and stuff over this sort of thing too, right? Like maybe her life's better for it, not being the voice of Siri.
I honestly think that's why they changed it, because I think people, they know. Like, they'll never say it, but they know they have the worst reputation for personal assistance.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, at least the most used and worst reputation. Like, Cortana isn't the worst reputation because not many people use it.
Exactly.
But it's a scale problem. So the other product that got reviewed is the Apple Watch Series 3, which, do you wear an Apple Watch? Do you wear a smartwatch?
I'm Samsung Gear 3.
That's totally cool. And it seems like no one, because it seems like you should not be getting an Apple Watch Series 3. The reviews were not kind. Seems like the software is good. The watchOS updates are great. But the added new functionality, it's a $400 watch, first of all, for LTE functionality. $400 that you're spending. That's more than the price of the entry-level iPhone. And $10 a month for LTE connectivity. Reviewers did not like it. The connectivity was very spotty.
And I still have a problem where it's like, I would never leave my phone and just use my watch. Mm-hmm. And so tethering to my phone is not an issue. It's not like they solved the problem by separating that from most people, I don't think.
I think there some reviewers are saying that there is anxiety that people, like, if you're an athlete and the phone, if you have a big phone, like, if you're separate from your phone, the watch is just a watch. You don't have all that functionality. Yeah. And so the killer app here is phone calls, which some people did not have great experience with the phone calls because the antenna isn't in the band like it is in a lot of other smartwatches with cellular connectivity. The antenna is in the case, in the outside part of the chassis. So maybe reception wasn't that great. And also Siri didn't function as well. Siri now gives you – that's the other killer app potentially is Siri with LTE functionality. It does read back to you. You hear the voice of Siri as opposed to just getting the text. But – it was spotty.
Well, one of my coworkers got one of these really cheap. I could be wrong, but I think he even said it was a $20 watch that he put a SIM card in and he could make calls on too.
Oh, wow.
And it sounded great. We do these morning walks and I'm like talking through my watch to his watch. And we're like, you know, trying to be like Voltron guys.
Of course. If you're going to do that, you hold it like this across your face.
That's Michael Knight.
And you don't, you know, elbows
nope,
down.
Nope. You got to be like really cool about it and everything. And
did Voltron use watches?
Oh, it was Battle of the Planets, I think, where Keop and all those guys, where they formed the big Flaming Phoenix anime thing. Okay, whatever. Uh-huh. I'm a nerd. But the the show I grew up with. But like that in my mind, that's like you see all this anime where people were talking through their watches and stuff like that. So we're just having fun with that. I'm like, why do we need to spend so much money when you can get something like $20 and get the same thing?
And like you said, I'm never without my phone.
Yeah. So a majority of people, I would imagine, are like that. Yeah. And so until you...
Even people who exercise. It's like everyone has their phone.
Oh, yeah. They're usually wearing them. They have ways to bring them with them at all times, too.
I mean, the ecosystem is tied pretty well together. Like, the other thing is, if you have the watch and you have cellular connectivity and you have the AirPods, they work really well together. Yep. So you could make your phone calls then. And I think, you know, don't buy the watch, buy the AirPods. It's my recommendation because I like those if you're on the Apple ecosystem. You have the TV yet, Jeremy, the new TV?
Comes tomorrow.
Okay.
I'm really curious about that because I've been without the TV for a while now, and I'm wondering, should I be?
I mean, do you have an HDR 4K TV? Because that's what it's good for.
That's what it's good for, and I'm planning on getting one, so that's probably the best way to go.
Primes it for the holiday season.
Yeah.
If you're going to spend, you know, $1,000, $2,000 on a 4K HDR TV, spending the, what is it, $300 on a...
$250
on the new Apple TV is probably worthwhile. Yeah,
that's if you get the big one. I mean, I don't even know why you need, what is it, 256 gigs?
Oh, the storage.
I mean, I honestly just stream everything anyway.
Yeah, I don't plan on playing games on it very much or anything. I just want
the apps and everything. Yeah, no, I got the baby one.
Yeah.
Oh, so even the movies you buy, you're still streaming. You're not downloading any of that.
They do download, but they download a la carte, and then they get wiped because
the memory management is all done. By itself.
I mean, and I have Sonic on the way, right? So it's everything.
There you go. I want the Apple service to know that I have gigabit give me the best bit rate, and I don't want your crappy bit rate.
The trucks are literally coming south along my street.
You can see them.
Yeah, no.
Every morning,
are you bringing them coffee? You bring them donuts. Donuts. Like, you guys are great.
I'm just down there.
Yeah. How soon do you get over there?
Wow, that's amazing. And of course, the big question is, of course, with the Apple 10 and Face ID. There were a couple interviews that came out after the keynote with Craig Federighi, who did the demo and that failed on stage. Yeah. You guys watched that?
Yeah, I did.
In the keynote? And, you know, they said that it failed because people had been handling the phones beforehand. But we learned a lot of things about Face ID. For example, Apple policy will not allow Face ID to work on kids.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yep.
Now, is that because they're harder to read or because of privacy concerns?
That's a good question. I think it's privacy concerns, even though they say that all this data is stored locally and never sent up to anywhere.
But they never had those restraints on Touch ID.
That's right. Kid Touch ID worked just as well.
It's weird. Mm-hmm.
Not sure why.
Maybe it's the likeness somehow.
And he talked about how, you know, you can still force the passcode by holding down the home button and the volume button, either the volume buttons together for a couple seconds. And
I want to see how Face ID, what happens with that from a legal standpoint. Like right now, there are multiple cases that have where judges have compelled users to input to do Touch ID in order to unlock a phone. And there's, you know, this it's has not yet to go to the Supreme Court. So this is not something that there is a clear ruling on yet. But the thinking is they have access to your fingerprints if you've ever been convicted. And so that's something that's in the public domain or in the legal domain. And so they can't make you input a passcode because that's freedom of speech. But they do have access to your fingerprints. And so they can compel you to use your fingerprint to unlock a phone. I wonder how that they have mugshots. Can that do they not have the right to make you scan your face? I don't know.
I don't know.
So that will go to court eventually. Yes. I'll be curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah. Another thing is that developers will have access to data, only the depth map data. Mm-hmm. So if developers want to use it for some type of computer vision program or for some type of security authentication, they will have some limited access to that Face ID system. My big question is speed, right? Like, yeah, how fast is it going to unlock? You can turn on and off the attention system, so you you can
really
it's an option. It's
so I don't have to look at the phone.
You don't have to look at the phone, and they did that for accessibility for people who are blind.
Interesting.
Don't know where they're looking at. That it will still work for them, but it's a toggle, and you it's obviously less secure.
Yeah,
if you don't have the attention system.
Yeah,
I'm curious about the battery drain of having these cameras and IR blasters on the phone always being used, and also like even with the demo of. The failure for the demo is because other people looked at the phone. Does the convenience wear off if other people touching your phone triggers the failure state and gives you the passcode unlocked?
Especially that first month that you have the phone and you're showing your friends.
Exactly, right? Everyone's going to want to look at your phone and it's going to trigger their faces or family members.
Yep.
Close facial structure because it's supposed to adapt over time, right? How's that going to change?
I've never even heard. Did they talk about like the twin situation?
They said twins will be able to unlock.
Okay.
Yeah, they jokingly said evil twin will be a problem. Right. Yep. But I mean, that's just acknowledging that someone with your same facial
structure. Well,
evil
twins always have goatees like I have, so... Or
even with goatees, well, yeah. I guess... So it takes a look at the eye distance, eye shape, mouth shape, nose shape.
Yep.
And those are the primary items. But to hear them say it, anyone internally who's been using this, it's just like how Touch ID, people use it now, can't imagine life without it.
Yeah.
They're saying that this is going forward, you won't be able to imagine life without...
Well,
Face ID without having to intentionally touch a button to unlock your phone.
We'll wait till somebody outside of Apple says that.
Yeah, exactly. October 27th, although I guess reviews will probably be out a couple days before that.
Have you guys played with any of the AR apps? Because that's another big improvement with iOS 11. So I have not either, but I'm planning to this afternoon. That's neat stuff. There's not a ton.
Yeah.
But I love that that's an SDK and that people are starting to play with it because it's the beginning of something that could be really, really great.
That's how it has to be done in my mind, is you just have to put it into devices that people are using every day, and then people start to like appreciate it and understand it and use it more.
Yeah.
And so far, the demos I've seen look pretty cool. It tracks things really well. It tracks things on solid color tables pretty well and everything. So I'm excited to see what comes out of it. We've got 3 things internally we're working on right now for it.
Oh, wow.
And so far it seems pretty cool, but it's all like in the kind of like reactionary stage right now. We have like partners working with who are like, we got to have stuff on that. And it's like, all
right, right,
go ahead and
right.
try stuff out.
Got it.
But before that, it was really challenging to get anybody even consider doing AR because they were lumping it up with like VR issues and business results and stuff. So now that it's like, and it's going to be in every phone going forward pretty much, and Google has their AR core and stuff, I think... For us, people who develop software, it's great because it means now people are kind of waking up to it. Like, okay, well, if it's going to be there, let's make stuff for it.
And it's a new challenge for programmers to figure out. I mean, it's powerful.
It is.
It's more powerful than people realize, and it's going to unlock a lot of creativity.
Yep.
We're going to give Apple credit for a news story that went that was misreported. We had talked about how the Boston Red Sox were disciplined because they had been theoretically using Apple Watches to steal signs for their baseball players. But it turns out they're using Fitbits.
Oh, there
it wasn't
you go.
Apple Watches, which makes the story much less interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
But they were stealing signs?
They were stealing signs.
That's funny.
But using Fitbits instead of Apple Watches. There was some malware talk this week.
Oh, this is
so bizarre.
This is great.
Do you either of you use
C
Cleaner?
I probably have used it.
Which one?
C Cleaner.
I have, yes. I have used it.
Stands for crap cleaner.
Yeah.
Who's it by? Avast.
Avast.
Yeah. So like apparently hackers embedded malware inside the freaking malware cleaner.
And it was used for stealing company secrets. It was used for for IP theft.
Wow.
I mean, that's just rude.
I'm glad I haven't used it in years, but still, that's bad.
So any copies of the installer that they downloaded, people
from the official site,
from the official site between August 15th and September 12th this year, a full month, and had the valid software issued by Symantec, had the malware. Yeah.
At this point, I pretty much just assume like my information is just in everybody's hands.
It's everywhere
at this point. Yeah. Like, you have Equifax going on. You have this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your laptop camera data. There's a server farm out in the middle of Iowa with video data from everyone's laptop.
Like,
archived.
I just feel bad for them then because like they don't need to be seeing what that camera's seeing.
You know, it kind of
YouTube reaction videos.
Yeah. Exactly. YouTube reaction videos of the video of me just sitting at my laptop. Yeah.
I feel bad for kids because we grew up and it was like we knew more about modems and connecting to computers than our parents did. Like that's just what we did. And we had to learn it all and we dealt with whatever negatives there were. But there wasn't this internet filled with malware.
Yeah.
And worms and Trojans. And I now have to like lock it all down because my kids aren't careful. And so I'm like, you can't download
your anything. Parents aren't careful and your kids aren't careful. Generation Gen X is the only generation
we are the
equipped
that's
to
it.
Solve this world's
that's
problems.
That's true. We are the meat of the careless sandwich.
It's horrible. Yeah, you're right.
Surrounded by gunk. Well, one thing that maybe, you know, we can only hope for companies to back us and to do no evil, as Google says they will. And maybe they're not doing evil with the latest update to Chrome. A future update version of Chrome will block auto-playing videos on all websites.
All right.
This is a big deal. Media publishers are terrified.
Yeah.
This is a trend that is that has been bad for the internet for a long time, but has generated a ton of ad money and
crack dealers are terrified. Cops are cracking down.
But this is—it's terrifying because this is Google, which works off of the ad industry, and it's them deciding what type of ads through the platform that people are viewing the website. They're controlling that. They're controlling the internet essentially, right? The way you view the internet, which can filter and do all sorts of stuff, and this is now filtering content.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's ad content or malicious content or whatever, they're still filtering content,
you know,
for their users.
It'll play out. If it's not the right decision, then people will stop using Chrome. And I have happened to think this is not the wrong decision. And it's not going to be a bad thing.
I might remember waking up, I think it was like sometime last year, thinking somebody was in our house because the audio was up on the computer.
Yeah.
Didn't hear a thing. And for some reason, an ad just popped right on up. And, like, and there was a conversation in our kitchen.
Oh, my God. For anyone who uses like a browser with, you know, more than 10 tabs, and I have like 25 tabs.
Exactly.
I'm just hunting because, you know, the best feature they added a couple of years ago was the little speaker icon next to the tab that's just playing the audio. But when you have tabs that are so small, you can't see that anyway. And I'm like, which tab is it? Which one is it? Which one did I scroll? What happened? Yeah, autoplaying video is a bane on our existence, and I'm glad, but it is scary because it is a lot of power. It is Google exerting their control. You
know,
they own the platform, the way you consume internet, and the actual internet itself.
It's not that scary. The web is still wide open. You have your choice of browsers. It's not like Apple doing something in the iOS ecosystem.
I'm sure Firefox is like, sure, come on over to us.
I mean, in the same vein, it's like Facebook. You know, auto-playing videos on Facebook is now the accepted thing.
Oh, yeah.
Auto-playing without audio, all it takes is for Zuckerberg or someone who running the team to say, you know what, let's turn on the audio, right? And and that's just something people have to live with. I thought on Instagram, they're experimenting with that now because Facebook owns Instagram, and they have the same thing of video that plays automatically but with no audio. If you hit the button, if you tap the icon with your as it's playing and you play audio, then for that entire session, auto-playing video will have audio.
Oh, wow.
Which I guess it's a compromise, but they want you to listen to the audio.
YouTube used to be where if your video ended, you didn't get another video.
Oh, yeah.
Now it just plays forever.
Now when I see how much data we go through every month, our statement.
I left the YouTube video on.
Yeah.
Right? And they don't care. It's not like Netflix where, are you still watching? No, they just want you to keep on playing.
They just keep going. Like every morning I see Geometry Dash video my son was watching the night before. Still going.
Still going, right? Still playing because YouTube still gets money for those ad plays. And it's why they want well, Face ID will be one thing. Why they want the cameras looking at your eyes?
Yeah,
they want to see whether you're paying attention, whether you're still there. Yep. It's not. It's just the jittering mouse function that you can
have.
They
can charge more for that.
They can absolutely charge more for that. Yeah. This is an interesting story. Did you see that? I think the University of Virginia, was it? Virginia Tech.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia Tech Transportation Institute was running some tests on autonomous cars. And we talked about how, you know, we're full believers in autonomous cars and a society run on autonomous cars. But one of the things that they'll have to figure out isn't just the pathfinding, but the social interactions. How people on the street right now, if I'm driving a car and a person's about to cross the street, I can make a decision, let them pass, and I give them, make eye contact and give them a signal, go ahead and pass, and they'll cross. With autonomous cars, there's no such emotional connection, visual eye contact. So they've been experimenting with ways, maybe light systems, right? You know, a light pattern, if it's blinking a row of LEDs.
On the car. That's interesting.
Right? If it's blinking this pattern, it means I'm about to go. If it's blinking this pattern, it means I'm in a stop position. Hmm. So I think that's useful because you want people to be aware of some transparency of what the driver, the computer in this case, is doing.
Right.
But there's also what people look at and what they care about when they see a car with no driver. And to test this, a couple months ago, they ran a series of tests where they had drivers in cars dressed up as the seats driving through their town and with cameras on people to see what their reaction would be like to the driver of those cars. So there's a video on Wired right now of what that camouflage system looked like, which is hilarious. it is a custom, you know, leather cover with the headrest with a screen through it, so it's like a mascot, you know, like an amusement park mascot, but with a mask with like a screen, and there's someone hidden in there, and the guy's a perfectly straight face, putting on his seatbelt, then putting on the fake car cover, and then driving the car. But the system didn't work because local news reports reported this was happening, and so people started gawking, and they started paying attention to these to poke fun at the people inside the costumes.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's because there was a news report, though. I mean, the whole problem with this experiment is, what is that car going to do is the second thing you think. The first thing is, what WTF?
Yeah.
There's nobody driving that car.
Which is important. Yeah. Which is also important to study. Like, I mean...
But eventually, that won't happen.
Right. But the onboarding process, the societal change, that is important to know. And that's something that, unfortunately, that we're going to have to... Unless you build a town like the Google town of just self-driving cars.
But like the Total Recall Johnny Cab guy in there, maybe they're a little better for it.
Right, but as we transition over to autonomous cars, it's going to look like the same cars, just with no drivers, which is jarring. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why some autonomous car designs just look completely weird, right? Like they intentionally have no front seat or have no steering wheel, and so you know.
Maybe you black out the windows like with like cars that have those kind of things when you don't think about who's driving that limo. Yeah. You just, all right.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's why Kit maybe was onto something. The light arrangement outside the car. Kit had it right.
It never changed.
It changed when he talked.
Siloed.
It did change when he talked, didn't it?
Not outside.
Oh, no, the inside did. The inside did the thing. Yeah. That's
the outside never changed?
No.
Oh, no, but.
I'm misremembering it.
But, you know, it was future think going on there.
Maybe Cylon.
Yeah.
Cylon's the way to go.
Yeah, because if you see a Cylon coming down the road, you're more comfortable and relaxed.
It changed it from red to maybe blue. A soft blue or a soft yellow.
And you're
color.
Pumping out ocean sounds. Yeah. As it comes
right or, I am aware. I see you.
It's that really nice video they play for when cows are going through the slaughterhouse kind of thing.
Oh, boy. You are no longer necessary. Buy this car.
Walk across the street if you must.
All right, one last bit of technology news. There's a new Kickstarter that launched. I'm still waiting for my Jibo. Do you guys remember the Jibo?
Yeah.
Which one was the Jibo?
The Jibo was before we had Alexa and before we had Siri and Cortana, the first promise of a digital home assistant. And this is like in recent memory.
That wasn't before Siri, was it?
Maybe it was after Siri. I think you're right. But definitely before Alexa, right? But this was the home kitchen device that was designed partly by a roboticist who studied human-computer interaction. And how could they design a digital assistant that had a personality, that you would imbue with personality, Jibo. Jibo was vaporware, because they had a, I think, a very successful Indiegogo campaign. I was a backer. I put $400 in this thing.
What?
And I'm still, and if you, I get Jibo posts, like updates on Facebook, and the, you know, we see the emoticons in the bottom corner, like people smiley. Most of those are angry faces. Like, where's my Jibo? Right? And my promise, Jibo, make me a sandwich. Jibo is finally shipping. They have some dev units out. And so I'm very excited. This is a home assistant that I don't know if they've, I haven't followed it, so I don't know if they've changed it so it now taps into Google Now or whatever. But the lesson learned is don't get too excited about these digital assistants that promise amazing features.
So this is applicable to what
the to a new Kickstarter that is now has 60 backers. 60 people are going to get this. It's $10,000 away from its goal as of today's recording. It's called AIRE, A-I-R-E.
I don't want to be mean, but this looks like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 skit.
It does.
It is a digital assistant that, get this, is also a drone. It hovers around by itself.
Sure it does.
It's a flying trash can.
It looks like they jammed an Alexa into the top of like a bucket almost with a drone underneath.
Right. With charging contacts and an aerodynamic landing surface and sonar sensors and a downward-facing sonar camera, you know, drone technology, concealed propellers, but it looks like an air filter.
It does,
like a room fan, but with an Alexa stabbed right in the top, like you said. And the promise is that it's going to fly around your house and come up to you and take a picture of you and have smart skills and be a real computer. In your house.
I can't watch this with sound for obvious reasons now, but do they actually indicate how loud it is?
I don't know.
Can it even hear you over its own sound?
So
it's great. It's flying around just going, what? What? What?
The beta model is $700.
Mm-hmm.
Estimated delivery end of next year, September 2018. And 17 people have backed it. 29 people have backed it at $750 for the robot.
I think you need to back this, Norm. I think you need.
If I had a Bitcoin, if I still had my Bitcoin, I would slice off a piece of that Bitcoin and put it in here.
This requires testing.
AIRE robot. Maybe it's ahead of its time. Maybe you know, just like the Jibo is ahead of its time, and now we have Siri with four different voices. Maybe
I didn't even play with the Australian voices.
Oh, maybe five different voices. Maybe. The time isn't right.
I can't wait for the show where we're all just kind of going, well, you know what? We were wrong.
Whoever backs this and gets one, you know, now you have a prop you can lease to TV companies who are making TV shows about the future, and you have only one of 60 of these in the world, and you can put it on your set dressing for your future sci-fi show.
If you connect a hypodermic needle to it, you'd have the interrogation droid.
You would. You are cosplaying the droid already.
There you go.
You've already formed an emotional relationship with this robot. So, you want for Halloween, I'll be Vader. You'll be the interrogation droid. High five, AIRE. Make me a sandwich. All right. Before we jump on to our next segment, I do also want to bring back a thank you to the sponsor for this week's episode of This Alien Test, and that is Squarespace. Support from today's show comes from Squarespace. They are what makes this show possible. And if you're ready to start your new business, make it stand out with a Squarespace-made website. With beautifully made templates created by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. You can showcase your work, blog, or publish content, or sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from look and feel to setting some products. I made my wedding registry website with Squarespace a year ago, and it was super easy, and I didn't have to go back to Microsoft Front Page. That was lifesaver. Go head over to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code TEST, T-E-S-T, for 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com with the offer code TEST.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
So it's like the old days.
It is.
And all right, so let's talk about some VR. This week, another Kickstarter launched. I haven't backed this one either, but it's for a VR headset, the Pimax 8K headset. Mm-hmm. Now, we published a video as this Kickstarter launched because we had a hands-on time with the headset. And let's be upfront with it. Yes, I know 8K doesn't mean 8K in this sense. What they mean by 8K is that they put two 4K panels side by side, so it's 8K width, but not 8K height. It's not four 4K panels.
Right. It's not 8K per eye.
Yes. It's not Not only is it not 8K per eye, it's not the it's 8K by 2K basically, mm-hmm. as opposed to 8K by 4K, which is what you closer to that aspect ratio for if you had a one 8K display, mm-hmm. one 8K. But we showed some impressions. You want to recast some of that, Jeremy?
Sure. I feel like the resolution is good. I feel like the field of view is wide, but the whole thing feels like it's not as refined an experience as what you get off the shelf from either HTC or Oculus. Both of those are just sort of give you a very tailored VR experience that basically represents what you would normally see if once you put on one of those headsets, the Vive or the Rift. You see through the, it feels like you're wearing a scuba mask, you could say. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a narrow field of view, but it's enough that crosses that threshold to feel immersing into a space. The Pimax gives you a much wider field of view, but it's distorted in a way that doesn't feel natural. And so there's trade-offs. If you're looking straight ahead, it's okay. But you're not always looking straight ahead. Your eyes are often darting, at which point the distortion becomes evident. Now, there was an interesting discussion on Reddit where they referenced our discussion about this, and they filled in some interesting information about how game rendering is done, essentially, and it's over my head. But basically, there's one render pass for your whole field of mm-hmm. view, and it's expensive to do that render pass. The ideal way to do this, like multi-monitor setups have had this problem forever, where the left and right monitors on racing games or whatnot have been distorted. And so this is the same problem recurring here. It's possible to do separate render passes for more views. So in the case of multi-monitors, for your left and right monitor. In the case of this, maybe for your peripheral vision. But that's very expensive to do. And so I don't see that as being something that's currently possible.
And in the SDKs for Oculus and for SteamVR, they tell the game what field of view, the ideal field of view, yeah. the headset will want. But none of them get the render pass. It never reaches 200 degrees. You're never going to get the full 200 degrees. That'd be extremely expensive computationally.
Yeah,
and so they are doing some warping mm-hmm. for the peripheral.
The pixel density is very good. I think particularly for virtual desktop use and movie watching, this is the best experience that you can get of anything, just for resolution wise, because you get close to all the pixels of your movie if you're in big screen or some mm-hmm. virtual movie theater. And if that's important to people, if most of their use is, you know, virtual desktop or big screen, this is a compelling product. Otherwise, I'm not so sure. It's an LCD panel, not an OLED.
It didn't have the didn't have smearing.
No, they call it a low persistence LCD panel, but you don't get those deep blacks. You know, it's not quite the same. Then again, do you really notice that because you don't have the frame of reference? Maybe not. It depends on the person.
Was the peripheral distortion artificial, or was it just because they were just rendering the one thing and wrapping it around, and you can't get that camera matrix to feel natural to your eyes? What was it that was really...
Well, they say that they have their own drivers, so okay. they don't require the game to render anything special for them.
Okay, now I see why there's...
So they grabbed the video signal, mm-hmm. and then what appears to me is, and I think we both share this opinion, was that they keep the center more or less one-to-one.
Yeah.
But they grab the edges and stretch the hell out of it.
Yeah, I see what's going on there. And ultimately, because like you're going to dot your eyes around, like you were saying, that stretch over there almost comes across more unnatural than natural. Ideally, you'd think the device would watch your eyes into where it was and distort on that peripheral as you travel your eyes around, and that would give you the natural... That gives you the display that you want. But it sounds like they're just working with what's there and not...
They'd say they have an eye-tracking module in development, yep. but we have never seen eye-tracking that has the low latency that we need.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be anytime soon.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And also, the model that we use wasn't true native 8K rendering. Mm-hmm. It was 4K upscaled to 8K.
Well, there were the panels were 4K each, mm-hmm. but the signal from the computer was 4K.
I see.
They do have an 8K native one that's
a pro model. We'll need two DisplayPort inputs.
Yeah.
But then you're talking about a very, very powerful graphics card or system to render that.
Yeah.
But if, I mean, we don't anticipate that Oculus or Vive will come out with an 8K equivalent solution anytime soon. So if you really want that persistency and scaling works for you, and with scaling, we were able to read web pages, really small web pages, and watch movies, then this may be a solution for you. And it's not super expensive, like $500 for that to get that. And if you want to work in VR, I think it's worth it.
And it is it does work with your HTC Vive wands and lighthouses.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, that's cool that they managed to do that.
So going back to HTC, mm-hmm. and HTC being sold, there was a tweet from one Palmer Luckey and said he will be speaking on the HTC Vive stage during Tokyo Game Show, and he thinks people will find it interesting. And the speculation is that he's going to buy HTC Vive.
He tweeted maybe a month ago asking his followers if he should.
If he should buy actual Vive.
Or actually maybe that was a Reddit post. But yes, he's just wide open. Should I buy it? He's got the money.
He does.
I don't think that's going to happen.
You don't?
And at Tokyo Game Show, is that the right place to make that announcement?
Doesn't seem like it.
No. Yeah. I'm really curious. We also have VRDC is going on this week in San Francisco. It's a small offshoot of the GDC, mm-hmm. But focused on VR. I think Will is actually speaking there this morning, actually. But we're going to be stopping by there, hopefully checking out some demos. I think Bethesda is going to have some of their VR titles there for demos. So
mm-hmm. That'd be cool.
I haven't used Doom VFR or Fallout VR yet.
Curious what you think.
Those are coming out soon, so I'd be happy to get some demo time with them. And then finally, Microsoft announced they didn't announce, but the word has gotten out that they are having a launch event for Windows Mixed Reality, which is going to be in San Francisco on October 3rd. And I can say that, unfortunately, we have not received invitation to go, so we're not going to that event. I know.
I should give you mine.
Want mine? I would love yours.
All right, let's talk after the show. We'll talk after the show.
Wow. Windows, Microsoft is obviously, and they're calling it mixed reality, but it's really VR. They've worked with a bunch of OEM partners, mm-hmm. from Acer, Dell, HP, and Lenovo, and Asus, and so they all have the standard for those headsets, and they use inside-out tracking, mm-hmm. and the demos that we've used so far, it's good enough, and so I think...
I would say it's surprisingly great. I mean, the tracking is like, how are they doing that so well?
I think it's surprising because we expected inside-out to be not good at all.
Yeah,
I would not say that we have not used it long enough to say it's good like or better than the current outside-in solutions. So it depends on the type of content you're going to be using it for.
And I haven't used it with controllers at all. So
yes,
that's a major question for me. But
right.
The headset tracking, it's pretty great. I mean, you put it down to the floor and it's like never loses. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, knowing that even with one camera, how good with translation movement you can track with the AR kit or AR core, you know, it's closer to being a passable inside out is closer to being a passable solution than we think. Maybe not solved, but it's getting there. Yeah. So we're excited. They probably will announce, my speculation is content partners for Windows, like, because what beta users have been using right now, I don't know if you have a beta unit, but it's like a virtual lounge, right? Your virtual mm-hmm. home, and you teleport around, and you can launch applications there, and you can have your Word documents floating in there. So they really want people to be in there as a productivity and immersive environment. But as anyone here who's used VR knows, like, the headsets aren't quite ready for that yet, and the content and the user experience, like, I don't see myself. I've done typing in a Google Doc in VR on big screen, but it's not something that I feel like I can move over completely to right now.
Yeah, it's more like I'd say the use that I've kind of played around with it is more to decorate the environment.
Yeah, right.
Feng shui my place a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, they have Minecraft, so mm-hmm. well, maybe Minecraft will be part of this. But still looking forward to that. And I think that is it for the VR Minute. Let's jump to our very final segment.
Testing this week. Hey, what have you guys been testing?
You had something we were talking about. What was it before the show? Were you going to talk about it on the show?
There was 101 things we were gabbing about.
I don't know. The only thing I can talk about is my new inkjet printer, which has to be the most boring thing.
Wow, okay.
So, I mean, really, I got nothing.
Why would you even bring up inkjet printer? Tell me about this inkjet printer for a second, because like I'm in the market.
Okay, it's the same thing I always do. Like the inkjet printer dies.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because I used, you know, third party ink. Who can say? And you know, then I go on Wirecutter. I say, what printer do you guys recommend? And then I spend the next 2 hours browsing the web, doing my own research, only to realize, of course, Wirecutter knew what they were talking about. Go back and I buy their printer. So I got some HP OfficeJet. I don't know, $120, and it came Prime Now. Thank goodness. Love the Prime Now.
Wow.
And then
I have to print in an hour. Get it over here.
It's crazy. Like, they're super easy to set up now, man. You just set them up, and the AirPrint, just like every Mac just sees it, and you print, and it works. You print, like, it gives you an email address too, so you can send it to your special code at HP, and like it prints.
You've become a FedEx location.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Give me that email address. I'll send stuff to your printer all the time. You can start an ARG that way.
Oh my god, I hope that email doesn't leak.
Something that we didn't get a chance to talk about last week is some pinball. You had some recent pinball acquisitions, right?
Oh my, well that's true. Yeah, I got my first electromechanical machine. So
oh really?
Yeah, what they call an EM.
Yeah,
and it's from 1977. It's called an Aztec, and it's a four-player game. If I knew anything about EMs, I would have gotten a one-player game.
Oh, yeah.
But it's just, there's relays everywhere. And there's not a single computer chip in the entire game. There's no memory of any kind. It's all hardware memory. So, like, its state is held by relays. And, like, they're just switches that just change state. And that's, like, it tells you what mode you're in, what you've scored, how many, you know, obviously, like, how many points you have. But also, like, if you have extra ball lit and what it takes to get extra ball lit. It's just an amazing accomplishment. Like the fact that they built this thing, and they built them every year, and they build multiple games every year. I mean, it's like 1970s technology is amazing. One, that it was accomplished, but also two, because it's right in front of you.
Yeah,
it's not esoteric. Like you just follow wires into these switches, and everything's exposed. You can understand how it works by just looking at it.
I mean, you're talking about an era that still blows my mind. Even into the 50s, I mean, like the Joniak and the ENIAC, and they had those like big memory, like in warehouses, memory would be in a warehouse for your like 16K.
Yeah.
And they'd have like women riding around on roller skates to swap out like the tubes, the eight tubes for the byte and that sort of stuff, which is like, right. It's just amazing it even worked at the time. And like, I look at pachinko machines the same way. Like, I'm always mesmerized by very intense non-electrical pachinko machines where I've tried to debug these things, and debugging something physically is like the most, it breaks my brain because I'm a software guy, and I just don't know even where to start. I've probably given away more pachinko machines because I just forgot or I couldn't figure out how to get the scoring to work again.
No, I needed help. Like I'm okay with modern machines, but I was so overwhelmed by, there are these stepper units in these things, which are basically like just huge stepper motors, but totally exposed, so you see how they work. And like, you have solenoids moving things forward and then grabbing a gear and pulling it into the next position. And it's just, and there's 20 wires soldered to the rim of these things. And it's just very overwhelming. So I had an EM expert come over, spend 8 hours with me.
Oh, wow.
Oh my God.
Fixing it. Because
I've seen some of those stepper gears are asymmetrical too. They're not just like some a lot of them are not just standard either. So you got to have them at the right spot in tune with everything else to do what you need.
Yeah.
Or the whole thing just, it's like a house of cards, just falls apart.
And people describe software development as a house of cards. This is just as much that like you can't have a switch wrong.
Well, definitely my software development, because like no engineer likes to work with me because it's mess one thing up, the whole thing crumbles.
You know, like it's true.
It
like,
is. It's absolutely true.
You miss a semicolon or you got some bug, it like affects everything. You got a switch wrong in one of these old EM machines, suddenly like that doesn't advance to the next player, and you just have to get out the schematics and trace everything and figure
follow
it out.
Follow wires and test. Can you run things without playing the game and
yeah, take the glass off, try to figure things out. But
is it working?
It is now.
Oh, cool.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, it is very, very cool. It's fun.
What's
want to
it
replace
again?
It's called Aztec.
Okay.
I want to replace the chimes. That's like, if I were to mod it, I would take the signals that activate these nasty sounding chimes and maybe do something electronically, or put a sound box to make any kind of sounds that I want, or maybe replace them with nice vibraphones, something like that. That might be a fun mod.
That's cool.
Very cool. Mike, did you remember what Jeremy was talking
about? No, I completely. I'm sitting around. I know we're talking about a lot of stuff I probably shouldn't talk about, but I have been doing without saying what it is right now because I can't. But I've been doing a lot more writing for television and animation, which has been an all new kind of like world for me because I'm used to programming, and if I need to solve a problem, I just solve it on my own and everything like that. And if I'm developing characters, I'm developing characters with mechanics, not with story arcs and this sort of thing. So our friend Gary, Gary whatever, always really kind of like, I'm like, man, he's really wrote Star Wars and done all this stuff and done all these great screenplays. Someday on my bucket list, I'll do this. So now I'm doing it. I'm like, I don't want to do this. This is the hardest thing ever. Like, I should just stick with programming. But it's been really fun. And like, hopefully we'll have some news soon on that too.
Yeah.
Awesome. Where can people find you online and the work you've done?
So, you know what? I'm trying to remember my Twitter. It's at Mike J. Micah on Twitter. If it's not that, it's at Mike Micah on Twitter. I'm always posting about what we're working on. But lately, I've been doing a lot of work with our Digital Clips label within Other Ocean. Digital Clips is the brand that we've established way back in the early 90s that takes classic games and modernizes them. It does the Criterion treatment. So we put like all the behind-the-scenes stuff. We talk to the creators. And then we try to actually enhance the games in certain ways that don't affect the original game, the core game, but add things like time attacks and features like rewind and stuff like that to make it a little more palatable for newer gamers. So that label's been really busy. We launched Disney Afternoon Collection not too long ago. Before that, the Mega Man Legacy Collection. We've got several projects coming up really soon. And one of the things I wanted to kind of like throw out there to your listeners is we're actually looking for people's opinions of what games we should be bringing back and what games that we think are that they think are very important to the game industry that were kind of pivotal games that you want to hear more about the story behind the making of the game, because we're actually going out there and trying to produce materials and video and all sort of things that help back up the and tell the story of what these games were and how they came to be and how they've changed the game industry.
Oh, I can see why you read Breakout.
That's why I'm reading Breakout. That exactly that, because I'm tracking down certain software titles that I think affected people in meaningful ways, and we want to make sure those things are brought back and understood and now like a historical document.
The thing I was going to ask you about was you talked about already Minecraft.
Oh yeah,
yeah. We hit that. Yep. But I did want to ask you about something. I discovered a new Laserdisc game I had no idea existed recently, called Cube Quest.
Cube Quest.
Have you heard of that?
It has all the really kind of like psychedelic visuals, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That like the gear, 3D gear stuff and everything. Like
exactly.
That, right?
Which actually were rolled into the Mind's Eye VHS.
I didn't know that.
Oh, I just read that on Wikipedia. But I thought I knew all the Laserdisc games. This is brand new to me, and it's really cool. It's like 1983, and like you're like this ship on this 3D wireframe thing that you plot and change your path, and you fly down. It's kind of Tempest-y. Not really. But
was that Sega?
No, it was some no okay. name. And like then that they ran out of money that it couldn't make. Like they had no money on it.
We were just talking about, remember Star Rider, that futuristic motorcycle Laserdisc game?
Yeah.
That game is not emulated by anybody. That's one that I keep wanting to try to figure out how to bring back, because they had done something really cool where they had this like oversized road that they kind of zoomed in the game. So when you turned and you were driving on the road, they'd move the video left and right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it made it feel like the road was natural, even though it was pre-rendered and had like these very stark Tron-style visuals and everything like that. And you had a lot of gameplay. You had overlaid game graphics on top of it, which those were my favorite Laserdisc games, like Mach 3. And there's another one called Us Versus Them, which people should really check out. It's the most bizarre, messed up sci-fi. It's like a 50s sci-fi movie set in the 80s. So you've got some really crazy acting and dialogue in it. But it's a shooter at the end of the day, like a classic like Gradius style shooter.
Where can people check out Laserdisc games online if they don't?
Well, that's the thing is like your best bet is to reference them. It's still just YouTube. But then there's a big community around the Daphne emulator, which emulates a number of Laserdisc games where people have ripped the Laserdisc and found ways to get these reproduced on PC.
Named for the princess from Dragon Slayer.
Yep, exactly. And there's a lot of work being done there. But then the MAME team also has some Laserdisc support. And that's the only way you're going to play games like Firefox, which was Clint Eastwood's.
And CubeQuest, by the way.
And CubeQuest, there, yep. So you kind of have to hunt around, and those are the two best places to start.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mike, for joining us this week. And we have our homework cut out for us.
Well, thanks for having me. This has been really fun.
Awesome. Jeremy, do we have an outro this week?
We do.
Awesome. Who's this from?
I'm not going to pronounce it. Crash.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
All blinking lights are cameras. Do not steal.
That's it.
Krasimir Valjak.